share with people now is your insight into the progression, the sort of Trinity progression. I've resisted this all along, so I'm not. And Johanna convinced me that we should probably pay attention to the cards in a progressive fashion. And I wanted her to explain it.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, this is something. Please forgive me if I cough, if I wind up in coughing a lot. I noticed. I've been looking at this Tree of Life illustration. As I told you last week, I did scan it. I did a color scan, and I have it on my screen throughout the sessions. And I'm looking at it, and I'm going up. Something clicked in my subconscious, and I told Paul about it. And Paul, if I forget a point, please feel free to, interject. I noticed that there are three sets of illustrations. The penciled ones, and two colored ones throughout the series, right? The penciled ones, when I saw it on the tree, it looks like it's the Father scale, or God the Father. Okay?
How do you get that?
Just listen. Let her give her the whole thing.
When you look at the Tree of Life, and you see that the pencil drawings are in very important positions, then the second level is God the Son, which is a colored illustration. And it's more detailed than God the Holy Spirit, which is almost totally blended. So I was saying to Paul, there are three levels to each card. And each card can appear more than once within a reading, depending upon the level the reading deals with. So, anything else, Paul? Am I missing something?
Well, that's basically, I've just said, as you most all of you probably have heard, I said that when we were analyzing this, just to look at the three images, see how they were similar and different, but not necessarily assume a sequence to them.
You know what's so interesting? I've been looking at the notes of Lisa Ray Gallo on the Tarot of Color, and I believe there's a king scale, a queen scale, and I forget what the third scale is called, of color, in the Golden Door.
Right. And if you look at the Kether, Bina, and Kokma, you see, I'm not even thinking properly. You see that the Bina has the third, I believe, the third illustration of the Empress on the Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the spirit of the
tree. That's the only colored illustration for the Empress, if I remember right. I mean, there's a couple of exceptions to where there's black and white.
I think the Hangman has four. One of them has four.
But
I agree. I think there is a scale, definite scale, and I do think it's Trinitarian, as Johanna put it.
I think that at this point, though, bulk of the time, I've not wanted us to read them sequentially. variety of reasons, mainly to keep the analysis simple and not to overextend it. In terms, it still does make sense to say that, okay, all of the images carry within them their own weight. In that way, it would make sense to see all the images as either the black and white scale or the sepia scale, if you want to call it
right.
That, which is which has been published. I mean, that weight Trinity set of cards were published some time in the past as cards.
The sepia set?
Yeah.
Was published?
Yes.
How did that went right over my head?
Well, I don't. It was a long time ago. Jensen had a copy of it that showed up when a friend of mine was visiting his.
I want to make one other point. And why these thoughts came to me, and why I broached them with Paul, was Marcus Katz is a ceremonial magician. It's not random that he put these cards where they are. You know, he's very ritualistic and methodical, somewhat OCD. You know what I'm saying? So there's a reason why one illustration is placed there. I mean, we talked about this in the beginning, even Cynthia and I. Why did he place certain illustrations and not others?
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's totally simple to put all the sepia or black and white.
Did Katz make that decision, or was it Waite that made that decision as to where they would go on the tree?
You know what? You're right. I don't know.
Don't forget the tree. And just consider that most of his are in a threefold sequence.
Okay.
All right? The tree, there was a selected number of what went up on the tree, and probably Marcus put those up there. I mean, I'm not saying he did or he didn't. But there is a sequence of the images. I just want to make a note of this. We've got a lot of other things to cover tonight, so I don't want us to talk about this interminably. I want us to review these images quickly and fairly so that we can get to our summary, because we won't have that much time for the summary if we get sidetracked on interesting points. Anybody, at that point, without completely shutting down this idea of the sequence between the images, does anybody have anything they want to say about it?
Well, I think that first image is quite interesting, and I looked at that image for a long time.
What image are you talking about?
About the one on page 165.
All right, you're talking about the star image, the sepia star image. Right.
And to me, looking at that, the way the water comes out of the pitchers looks like the two pillars on the Tree of Life, pillar of force, pillar of form.
Okay.
And the top is standing on Malkuth, if you like. The
right.
In her chest is a 10-pointed star. And that
right.
star to me represents the total picture of the Tree of Life with all the sephira.
Right.
And then above her head is the star that is flipped down from Keter down to Dot.
Right.
Definite depiction to me of the Tree of Life, and it's very focused on this figure, which I would really read as a Shekinah.
Well, yeah, it's interesting is that if you actually count the stars, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then you take the two pitchers of water, 8, 9, and then you take her feet, you have 10.
Mm-hmm.
The ground or the water at the bottom, I suppose.
But if you look at the middle star there, the one that has the 6-pointed star, that is the reflection of Keter, okay?
Right.
And that Keter, that becomes Dot.
Right.
In that particular part.
Right, and so in this case, the Keter's not pictured. It's in other words, the actual crown is still dark.
That's right.
Here. really good observation. I really appreciate that. Let's look at the two color images now. Notice that at the bottom of the first image, which is very sort of washed out, there, the very bottom says Malkut.
Right.
And the but the symbolism still holds up to a degree. Except here, the star of the crown is looks like it could be Keter rather than Doth.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is how washed out this is. But following Johanna's observation, there's more still particular detail in this one that looks so washed out compared to the third one, in which the star image is decidedly nude, and the other two are clothed, to the center chest star is no longer there, or no longer present explicitly. And it's interesting that it isn't expressed explicitly that there is this going. So we have those three images there.
Would you say has returned? Possibly, because of the way Keter has dropped down. Excuse me.
It's amazing, the third picture, there is a very faint outline of that star on her chest.
Yes, I thought so, but I wasn't sure. I agree.
Yeah, and we'll also, it's Netshak, Netzach Malkut, right? The Lady of the Star Dispensation. And also notice that the star is one of our Shekinah things. Classically, the star represents Aquarius. All right, moving on. We're gonna talk about all the images again. We want to move on to the second to the last one, which in this case is the Blast Tower, the Tower of Babel. And the description is on 168. And for me, the interesting point here about this tower is it's on a hill. And in some ways, the way the hill is drawn, it's almost like a stylized lightning bolt, which is classically of the other stylized lightning bolts of other versions. And you can see from the color versions of the... The other thing about this is that you have... a four-world demarcation of the thing, where you have one section, two sections, three sections, four sections of the tower. I'm pretty sure, I looked hard for the bird. There's a bird in the second picture. Again, the way the tower is on the hill, there's emphasis on a cave in the hill.
In the second one?
All of them.
Okay.
First one, it's a very small cave down at the very bottom of the
All right.
The other one is much larger, and the darkest one, the third one, is much bigger. And it's not necessarily a cave, it's just sort of like, you know, somehow these jutting rocks come out, and there's this, come through this, as if this is an island jutting out of the ocean.
Did you feel that this was a kind of apocalyptic image in that the pencil drawing, the sepia drawing, to me, seems like something made in ancient, possibly made in, it could have been made in ancient times. The second tower has more of the medieval kind of crenellations, is that the right word? And
yeah,
the third image, well, this looks like one of the twin towers.
Well, also, when you get to the third one, in which the breakdown of the towers reads the three possibilities are not quite clear, except you can see that there's that it's split in two, and the crack goes all the way down to the bottom. I want to point out to the commentary the emphasis on Ha being corresponding to language.
Mm-hmm.
And that the shin is, represents tooth, which is usually important when one speaks, needs teeth. And so so we have this orientation of the tower here representing. Also, this gives an interesting apocalyptic version of the tower that gives us a sense of meaning with the other great image that we had back before, which was the judgment. So this is an interesting place where the tower is the place where judgment is.
Right.
And so there's some kind of orientation towards regeneration. Might be one of the ways of looking at it. Again, pointing at Johanna's threefold thing, we have the sepia vision, then we have the color one, where there's much detail, and the colors are sort of on the purple side, and then the one where the details are sort of more washed out, and it's more tends towards a greenish hue. Anyone have anything they want to remark about the tower, or any of the, or the star at this point? Does anybody have an idea of what the bird might symbolize?
Now, where are we going to find this bird? I've been looking and looking.
The bird is outside the tower in the second picture, with the one, the purplish hue, and it's sitting on the grass knoll.
I see it.
You see it?
It's like a little red bird.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A little red bird with like a green head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah.
I know there's a bird in the first picture as well.
And it looks like a man.
Yeah,
to
the left of the staircase.
That may be a man and a woman, because to the other side, I think is a figure of a man.
Oh, it looks like a little mouse. You look at that with a magnifying, has a tail on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I look for a bird, but with my blurry eyes or my lousy glasses, I wasn't able to quite see that. So thanks for pointing that out. And actually, on the third, if you go back and looking at the third picture, you can now see that there are obviously one or two bird images also in the third picture.
There are.
And that the second a bird image in this in the purple picture may be completely on the other side of the grassy knoll on the other side of the tower. I don't know exactly what that looks like. There could be a bird image there.
The letter Shin looks like fire. It's called the fire. And the bird is red on that, so it maybe represents the fire.
And it's a little white in this, in the case of some of the other ones. Well, okay, we don't know what exactly the bird might mean, but we know it's there. And the bird is not flying. The bird is standing. That's an interesting point. You know, the bird is not flying. The bird is standing in the world with this, you know, this lightning coming down from the sky. Might represent some aspect about how the transcendent and the Malkut transcendent moving upwards comes to almost a stalemate of how things can go. And maybe thinking about that, that's the classic view of the fable of Babel. One interpretation of the fable of Babel is human beings were building this tower to reach heaven so that they could talk to God face to face. And the bird not being resting on the top of the hill and not flying is an example of saying, not to go any farther.
That's interesting. Yep.
Well, that's not necessarily. That's a possibility.
But I don't really understand the title "Perpetual Intelligence" for the 31st path. If you place the tower on it, but I mean I'm not a Kabbalist, so. And that it says why is it so called? Because it regulates the motions of the sun and moon in their proper order, each in an orbit convenient for it.
Go on forever and forever and forever, perpetually.
So are we to say these images go on forever and ever? What is there a spatial relationship, a time and spatial kind of thing too?
Well, why don't we keep that question in mind?
Okay.
And bring it in when we're dealing with the synthesis of all the images.
Okay.
Because that's something that we may get, but there may be a momentum that we get when we try to synthesize the images on the Tree of Life. We may see a momentum which may answer some of these questions, or may give us at least a direction in which that leans us in one direction or another with how we might respond to the question. Let's deal with the last card again in the sequence, which is Malkut, it is the guardian of the gate, the restorer of the world, the Shekinah, let's look at again the last one for the world, the letter is the Tau, which is the cross, means mark or sign. The Tau also, represents, the four quarters or the five directions when you consider the center as a separate direction from the poles.
The Tau cross isn't like a Christian cross. It's a T-shaped cross.
it's T-shaped, but in this case, you could still put it. For instance, if you wanted to put the T-shape in the image, you would have bringing together the eagle and the lion, and crossing the genital portion of the of the world figure, and then go down
bar.
To the down to the bull at the bottom would be one way to put the T in there. The figure more the figure of the world, the Shekinah in this, she is carrying two wands in her hands, and she has sort of like a moon or a third eye rising up, and then there is another star. Obviously, much more apparent how that functions. So I wouldn't necessarily the moon function isn't necessarily apparent. And the second world, the colored world images. In the blue image, as opposed to what we'll call the other one, the darker image, the third one. In the blue image, her drape that goes around her is more serpent-like, and that, of course, is not necessarily, it's not fully the case in the other drapery. There is definitely a greater predominance of the star at her feet, which is not apparent in the other cards. But the fact of the way she has the wands are raised, they're raised in a way in which they're being used.
Mm.
In other words, she's using them. In the third image, the long hair. Well, it's actually in both. The long hair is in all the images. It's most predominant in the black, the sepia, and also the third one. She has the long hair. She's essentially nude, but with a slight drapery around her. And her wands are touching the rim in the third image. The oval is sort of more narrow in a way. And we have the classic four images, which are the zodiacal and images.
The face of the angel of the man at the top is more reminiscent of some of the faces we've seen before in design, since it's the second image of the lovers. And somewhat of the devil, but it may just be his style. Also, here we go. If you flip through the images,
you're talking about the second colored one.
Yes, the second colored one.
You know, the, of course, the main difference is that, you know, you got a blonde up there as opposed to a, we have...
No, I'm sorry, I'm not talking about the second one. It's the third one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Even though it looks like he has wings there.
Yes.
Yeah, they are. It's that's classically what it is.
Right.
It's a seraph. and there's, you know, obviously in the second one, the blue one, there's a, it's more woven into the design, whereas in the dark one, he's outside of the design, outside of the oval.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's one of the major differences between those two is the placement of the quarter
space. Yeah, well, the second one, it looks like feathers, which would represent air.
Right.
Aquarius.
Okay, so I want to wrap it up, and we're going to start with Doc on the second. But so the wrap up is on the last three images that we've just dealt with. Anybody's got anything they want to say about them before we try to come up with a synthesis of what all the images mean in a meditative, mythical framework?
Well, all the images dealt and this entire presentation deals much more openly with the mystery of Doth than in the Golden Dawn presentation that I'm used to seeing and hearing about. And at the astrology seminar that Walt Amberstone gave, he dealt with the Gratri as in the Sefer of the Sefer Yesara, and it would be in, let's see, I believe the text he used is right here, Kaplan's text on the Sefer Yesara. So if you have that, you can take a peek at it, where astrologically,
it's kind of week four, people, if you want to look at it.
Yeah, there's many connections to Doth, and Malkuth sort of drops down. It's, in other words, it's after the fall. The Gratri very much represents the fall, and thus Doth.
Okay, now whether for good or for ill, and I'm willing to entertain other alternatives here. My understanding of the sequence of cards is that what we're dealing with here is the path of illumination. It's basically the restoration of the human being to the paradisical state. It isn't the path of unity. It is. The illumination state is the path of unity in the sense that it prepares you for the realization of pure unity. But these images are actually trying to show how through sacrament. And the sacraments are primarily Doth. We go back to plate 1 and pick 88, and the priest officiating, or priestess, well, since it's not really clear, we got an obvious priest with the 11th crown on Unitas, and a host held up to his heart, and the chalice, sequence of around in the circular thing with two towers behind, and then the other two images, another black and white image of the priest holding the chalice and the host aloft, even above the priest thing, and then the colored one, which is bright yellow, and which three steps are definitely demarcated below the feet of the priest, which could represent the three levels that are underneath the Doth, that represent, you know, the world underneath the Doth. You have the host held at shoulder or eye level, shoulder eye level. The host and chalice, body and blood. Okay, so what are we talking about? We're talking about the sacramental Eucharist, the way that Christians participate in the divine humanity of Christ is through the Eucharist, through eating the body and blood of Christ. It is a sacramental, magical act that's utterly open, and that in this case, this sacramental magical act is what basically is the force that brings, that carries everything through the meaning of all of this stuff. It fits in with Waite's devout Catholicism and use of the Eucharist.
Interesting. I looked at that picture. We look at page 88 and that first picture of Dot. The two pillars, the church on one side and the tower on the other side. That tower looks like the tower. The second picture of the tower. You know, that's the pillar of force. A pillar of form, structure, you know,
all right.
That just needs to be broken down. And that top of that tower looks like the tower that's in the second picture of the tower.
Well, also think, too, that we can also see that on the left and the right, with the, if you look at the two other things, where you have the host, you know, on the left and on the right, and the cup. And so that the cup and the host represent the two towers here too, but also in the sense of the body. So they represent two ways, but they also represent one Eucharist. You know, one mystical act of illumination, and that's the emphasis here that I would put on it. Now, as we go through these images, feel free anytime to, when you think of something that you want to say about the images or about images that we just passed through, about what you think their significance is, this is the time to do it. So I'm encouraging you to talk when you want to. Don't allow me to bully you into listening to me. And I know, David, I know that you don't need this encouragement. And Cynthia doesn't need it that much either. But other people, feel free to bring in your own interpretation in terms of how you're seeing this stuff integrate. So we move to the beginning of the sequence, Sirius. In other words, some ways the priest here is like a fool card. In another way, it's extraneous to the whole process. And yet it does represent what the process is. You could say then the Doth is the way of illumination, the illumination that's necessary so that one can ultimately be embraced by the full unification, which, as I said, is the thing that's opening us to that ability, not to the levels of realization that are within the unitive states.
In Roman Catholicism, the communion sacrament, which is being portrayed, is transubstantiation, literal body and blood of Christ. And I'm not sure whether that holds true in all Christian churches.
I don't think that's something we really need to concern ourselves
with. Okay. But I think it's definitely that here that was.
Yeah, when I think about that, though, and that's a very important part of that tree of life to me, it's like the gateway into the other side of the tree, and to me, it's the gateway into the divine, into the cosmos. So at the point of death, that's the point at which we all go through into the cosmology.
Yes. And the thing that we're missing
with this priest on this particular card, that he's saying that this is Eucharist is the same thing. It's the gateway into the
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. In other words, there was a full path of purification that came before, which we could say is it's the Golden Dawn path working on the Tree of Life, in which Doth is not emphasized. When you've fully done that path work, which is a basic purification, then you're ready for this mystical illumination, which will prepare you, purify you in a deeper way. So you've gone through one purification. The path of illumination is a deeper purification. It gives you it opens for you the capacity for you. Basically, is my basic way of understanding it is a return to paradise. Paradise isn't back to the unity of God, but paradise may be where you go, and then you have the choice of going on to become God's friend, or basically hanging out in the for the good stuff that one has in the court of the divine. A lot of people are quite happy not going beyond the illuminative way. I'm not saying that Waite understood this thing in quite the same way that I do, because it isn't clear from his writings whether he does or not. But let's move on to the Emperor.
But I agree. I think that this whole thing with God is the beginning of the journey.
Yeah. So then, moving on to the Emperor. We have the Emperor as the masculine face of God descending into Chokban. And it's sort of going from Keter. And Keter is actually not portrayed ever in this thing. So in other words, we don't have a card that is at the place of the crown in this sequence. What we have is and also Doth is not, as though if we have things going back and forth to Doth, we don't have it. So we have the Empress and the Emperor. And I really do see them as the sort of masculine feminine, the divine masculine and divine feminine, as together representing the two degrees. So the Emperor and the Empress really hold together. And noticing again with the Emperor, there's only two images, both of which are black or sepia, and there is one colored image of the Empress where she's sitting. Notice that she's sitting on a hill, and this hill issue doesn't really recur to us until we get back down to Babel, which we just dealt with. So,
actually, I think it's the top of the towers.
I agree, Cynthia. For both the Emperor and the Empress.
Yeah.
Well,
the thing is, first, if Paul, the Emperor's on the path 11, and path 11 is normally the path of the Fool and the Golden Dawn. And so he's changed these paths, obviously.
Well, that's what we're dealing with now. We're dealing with the obvious changes in the paths,
right,
as it relates to how we understand the cards and the kind of unfoldment that this represents.
And I think it's a very logical way, actually, from a Christian point of view, from a Judeo-Christian point of view.
Yeah. So we have, but I think that there's an important symbolic relationship between in terms that where there are hills, there are not a lot of hills of this thing, so we definitely have the tower on a hill, which is a unique representation of that, and we have the Emperor and the Empress seated on a hill, And they are seated. That's an important thing. And we could also say that with the tower, the bird is not flying. So you could say that could be like a seated bird.
The Holy Spirit.
Well, classically, yeah. Classically, the you know. And then the third one that brings these together is the wheel of fortune.
Right.
Which is here Keter to Das. So we have Keter to Bina, Keter to Chogma, that was the empress of the emperor, and now we have the wheel of fortune, which is Keter to Das. And which is interesting here, specifically, is Das is kind of where we entered here. And then our sort of looking at the emperor and the empress, we're not there directly. They sort of, in some ways, I would almost see them as accompanying us. And here, the wheel of fortune is a very interesting choice. And a buoyant there. And that, you know, again, it's the angelic image. Again, in this case, no color choices here. We've only got two sepia images of it. And we have the wheel and the eightfold wheel here, that eight spoked wheel, so the hold it. And so here we have a bringing, as it were, into form, change, the way the world's going to work. And of course, what I see here is I see, as much as I see the emperor and the empress as paired up, I see the wheel of fortune and the chariot as paired. They both are wheels. One is the wheel that holds the whole together, and that's from Keter to Das. And then the chariot, which goes from Das to Chogma, is holds the wheel that in this case, represents true transcendence, an interesting flying here. That it's Chogma represents that it's oriented towards the masculine, the divine masculine, and of course the chariot figure is again only no colored ones here to choose from, but you do have the emphasis here on the transcendence. And then, of course, then strength becomes the Bina Das connection. And so here you have the sort of difference between these two angelic presences, where so you have a connection between the emperor and the emperor and the chariot and strength, emperor and the empress and chariot and strength. And then you have the wheel of fortune. The wheel of fortune holding itself, sort of almost like creating the dimensions in which, so the chariot and strength sort of represent the movement of grace. You know, the wheel sets out the directions of the possibility of grace and of knowledge, but the movement of grace is in the chariot and in strength. And then again, we have connections, which is the magician, which is Chokma and Chesed. And again, the magician is connected to the chariot. And the fool, Doth Tepereth, is moving down. In fact, I think that's the last place where Doth is present in the tree, as far as connecting to characterizations. And it moves on to Tepereth, which moves into another level that doesn't start to get seriously dealt with until we get to the Hermit. So again, it's, from my point of view, it seems that there is a classic connection between Mercury and Uranus, between the magician and the fool. However, I'm also highly wanting to relate the Bina Gebereth with the magician. I don't think we got Chokma Chesed for the magician. And then we have Bina Gebereth for the high priestess, which seems more to pair up with the last judgment of Chesed Gebereth. Anybody got any sense of that? You know, one way of following some of what I'm saying here is to look at the look at the tree itself rather than the individual's images. But maybe the better thing to do is just to go backtrack and going back to the images, looking very specifically at the magician and the symbolism of the magician, which is Chokma.
God doesn't actually do any miracles. He sends an angel to do the
miracles. Or the way miracles are performed,
yeah,
or through angels rather than through. Moving on to the fool. Doth and Temperance. Well, we see the fool classically, shows Doth as sort of a vast unconsciousness, and Christ crucified to that in a way. Down to the point where it's Fedar, which could be seen as connecting with Temperance. And that which makes sense. So in some ways, where the feet of the fool are is the sun, where the center, the sacrificed center, the heart, the breast, the center of the classic tree of life, Epirus, one of the most powerful things related to that. The high priestess again goes from Bina to Geburah. A take on how you would see the high priestess in Geburah?
Well, it's very difficult to see what he's doing here. I don't understand why the high priestess is generally in the Golden Gong goes from Keter to Tiferet.
Right.
And then the high priestess, he's put here between Geburah and
Bina,
right?
Yeah, right.
Between Bina and Geburah.
Yeah.
Karina is about understanding, and Gavor is about limitations. And the high priestess is, I don't know.
Well, I'm seeing the high priestess and the magician as in cahoots in a way with this. I need to, let's see, I may flip over to the chart.
Well, they are in cahoots. You think about the high priestess as being just the Divine Mother and the High Priest and the Magician being the Divine Father. Emperor being the physical father, the Empress being the physical mother. You get a pairing.
Yeah, I think that one of the ways, I don't think I'm going to get it completely straight in this review, but one of the ways to seriously look at that is to look at the three pillars. I didn't make notes on my on the notes that I draw up. I didn't make notes on the pillars, but it probably makes sense to look at the right, the left, and the central pillar of the Tree of Life, seeing how these images line up with that to help get a sense which would help a little more with getting a rationale for how these things align in terms of the evolution. But if we just go along kind of following the number, the transformation of the fool with the high priestess, then represents a characterization of specifically and related to the fool of basically Mary Magdalene in this case. And I mean bringing Mary Magdalene into this, not as the consort of Christ, but as the the first witnesser of the resurrection, and also the first person to go to the tomb of Jesus after the death, and becoming the initial witness to the resurrection, but also the fact that the high priestess takes care of the death issue here. So the sacrifice of the fool, and in some ways the descent into the underworld, or ascent into the underworld. So it's, in other words, it's and the notes that Marcus and
sorry, I got knocked off.
That Marcus has here on the high priestess, you know, emphasize to a degree what that is. Bina and Gebaru equates the value of eight, which is chef. Chef is the fence or barrier or enclosure. The enclosure here of the high priestess represents, in a way, the tomb or the womb of this transcendent thing. And if you look at the image of the high priestess, all the issues of her not being so much a tomb as being the incubator of light, and the whole issue of this, of a pillar of light emerging here, is highly suggestive. Not only, also the ascension of the Virgin.
Yeah.
And the Isis crown on the, and again, we have, the high priestess is sitting. And sitting, classically, where we have sitting poses, we have her functioning in a, place where, it's not she that's being transformed, but she's rather holding the transformation, which, by the way, is the way I would interpret our sitting figures of the emperor and the empress.
Could you explain what you mean by holding the transformation?
Well, the transformation that's going on here is that she's acting as the womb, the tomb, or the place of incubation for the resurrection of the fool. I mean, in other words, we don't have the full crucifixion going on here, but we have that, and that's what she's holding. So because she's holding it, she doesn't herself need to be the, she's the vessel. You know, when you do something inside a vessel, the vessel doesn't change, but what happens inside the vessel changes.
So we are inside of her.
Well, I think that's what she is.
Yep. And the little figure who stands at the bottom?
Yeah. That's obviously, all figures that are standing are going through transformation.
Okay.
That's, I'm not saying that's the only way to interpret the standing figures, but that's, you know, we were asking for the last 5 weeks, what's the difference between standing and figures? What's the difference between being nude and being clothed? What's the difference between the angels' wings and where they are? And now we're going to go into that aspect of the transformation. And we go into that transformation with the Last Judgment. Let's look at that. Let's look at that card. For one thing, now the darkness, which was above the fool, is now below. And we have an ascending figure who is clothed in all three things with a halo. In one case, two cases, definitely a crown. We have a angelic figure above, obviously light, and we have a barrier of a rainbow, and the rainbow could definitely mean like the various levels of light. And in fact, it's in the colored one, it looks even almost like a prismatic light.
And the rainbow is a covenant with God.
The rainbow is the symbol of a covenant with God.
Mm-hmm.
However,
mm-hmm.
I would not overemphasize that here. So obviously, we want to pay attention to that rainbow when it comes up again, at least in suggestion when we deal with it.
Has left the conference.
Undersea version.
And the position of the hands has changed.
Which hands are you talking about?
In the Last Judgment, in the third figure, the second, the first colored, the hands are slightly higher up. The feet seem more grounded in the air for whatever reason.
Which figure are you talking about?
The second colored figure in the Last Judgment.
No, but are you talking about the one...
not the angel.
The angel.
No, not the angel. The ascending figure.
Okay. Yeah, so you have these, sort of like, I don't know. I'm not quite sure what to make of that hand gesture as they seem to be prepared for a trade. Acceptance, benediction, thy will be done makes sense for the sepia-colored one. But for the other one, the way they sort of stick out there like little wings, I don't know what to make of that at all. That's symbolic. Continuing to trot along here at breakneck speed, this is the hermit, where, by the way, we have Pant as one of the names for God of its meaning. And the hermit is between Chesed and Tepereth. You could say that in one we had an obvious ascending into light, and here we have the hermit representing light in the in a sort of abstract space way, which actually in a lot of ways is very symbolical with the second card that comes up. Instead of a hermit, death seems to be connected here. Geberuth, Tepereth, and Chesed, Tepereth. The hermit, death, sort of dyad, seems to be close. In the hermit, we have the hermit, in a way, really in space. And we have the whereas with death, we have the underworld represented, or a star of light of the soul moving upward out of the underworld, and we have someone prostrate, which we said is because their face is down, that it could be a form of humility. And we have another version of the star moving out of a crypt. And again, the out of the crypt issue with death, and the star coming up with death can also represent this process that starts with the fool, goes with the high priestess, goes through judgment and the hermit, and becomes a commentary on phases of the soul, or actually the way I would see it is phases of the way light is held. You could say in some ways it could be the function of how one is held by light and how light holds one's soul. Now, this is a purification of your soul so that you can become aware of the pure spirit. The pure spirit is yourself. It's not different than the divine. It's the unitive way. It's a way that I don't think is dealt with in this card. It goes with the path of unity. Following that, we're going to we move on to the Hierophant, and anybody can jump in anytime they want to. The Hierophant here is an interesting view. I mean, we've gone.
That's the face on the world card.
That's right. Because actually what we have with the Hierophant is we have, we've gone from all the images that we've been dealing with before. It starts with the magician, the fool. Well, the magician deals with human-made artifacts. Doth deals with human-made artifacts. The Hierophant deals with human-made artifacts, but the High Priestess, human-made artifacts, but in a light way. The Last Judgment and the Hermit, a lot of it is in death, where we're dealing with natural symbols and very little, artifacts, very little things that are made. And in this case, we went from the cave of the Last Judgment to the church cave of the Hierophant sitting. Though in some ways, we went through a period where there was some very deep transformation. All the characters are prostrate or standing or and moving, ascending in various ways. And here we have the Hierophant. And the Hierophant is enthroned and sitting still, which means that one of the things the Hierophant represents, if we're going to take seriously the difference between standing and sitting in these cards, is that the Hierophant represents a certain degree of stability, of order, of direction. In this way, probably the classic understanding of the Pope as the representation of Christ on earth. Not because it necessarily deserves to be the representation of Christ on earth, but the ability of that is so solid that it doesn't require. In terms of the office, it doesn't require change. It would also be the stability of the dogma or the teachings of the church. Or the stability of the revelation. Where you have natural revelations in grottos and caves and outer space, those things are mutable to a degree. They represent a phonic level of this unfoldment of light, and that's balanced with revelation that's human, even in the sense of artifact and artifice and law and direction and understanding. And that could, as it says here, it represents the church. And by the way, that's probably the most generous view of the Hierophant I've ever done in my life. The Ark of Tradition, which is depicted as the drowned master, the hanged man, which is at the opposite side of the Tree of Life. So we haven't got to the drowned master yet, but we're about to get there because it's the next image, the hanged man. Which is Geburuth Hot. And here we're going back to what was going on with the Last Judgment, where we had the rainbow. Here we have the rainbow in with the drowned master. Also, the way the robe is around the master in the first colored card is very similar to the world. You know? Look at the, you were concerned about the face. Look at the face on that drowned master there and the face you saw in the world card. We have above the ark, and I'm, in this particular case, the ark meaning a boat floating around, representations of fish. In one case, we have the drowned master within a sarcophagus of that is in the sepia one, the black and white one. It's in a sarcophagus that is a swastika, you know, representing golden.
For whatever reason, the hanged man, the crowned master, is dealt with in by Marcus Katz. I feel more fully in the Hierophant, actually, where he gives.
Yeah, read it.
Okay, the Hebrew letter gives in, this is the Hierophant, gives indication of tradition and teaching associated with the image. The Hierophant is the faith of man, whereas the drowned master is the symbol of the covenant of God. It is also the ability of man to access the Christ Center in Tiferet, the Sephira, which means beauty. And then he quotes the poem of Waits. Is, do you want me to read that?
No, don't read
okay.
that. Yeah, well, I think that the Hierophant is representing that access to the Christ Center, whereas the hanged man is the soul, like the dove, takes flight from the ark when awakening, as depicted next to the symbol of the sun, which follows the rainbow in the dark. There is no image of the thing. So what we're dealing with, I think, is something that actually is fundamentally more mysterious than what's intimated by that point in the Hierophant. That in some ways the church is saying, well, we preside over these mysteries, but the very next mystery that we have goes right to the heart of death and regeneration, and it also goes into the restoration of the paradise just by the looking at the images of it. Again, the key images are the water, are the rainbow, is the swastika, and definitely going to the world card, the last card in the sequence, as the fulfillment to a degree.
We have four treatments, four images as well, which
right.
is unusual.
As opposed to the two or three that we have most of them.
Right.
Yeah.
So some special emphasis is made here, and
well, the other thing too is the
Marcus sort of hits some information within the Hierophant as opposed to placing
it
here.
Two other things going on here too is that we're dealing with a sitting figure and a lying figure.
Right.
We don't have too many lying figures. And this figure, the other lying figure that we have is face down. This figure is in the water, and I would, you know, it does represent a radical version. Now, in some ways, part of the mystery of this is some of the bridges for this mystery comes up with the next verse.
I'm sorry, Paul. Did Avalon think? I know this is a crazy question, but I believe in the mythos of the King Arthur and all that, the Isle of Avalon sank, and it's almost like Atlantis or whatever. Not that I know that.
Oh, okay.
All right. It's a myth.
All right.
think that, for me, Drowned Master has something to do with the Grail legend. And Wig was very much taken with that. And I go so far as to say as the Hidden Church.
Well, I would emphasize rather the actual archetypal gravitas of being underwater as a form of being within the womb again. And and in some places there's a in the way the image is set up for us, because the image is lying down and is encircled in a way, there's a kind of it's sort of like what happens in the cocoon. You don't see it. You don't see the transformation. And where you get a view of the transformation, a return to the transformation, is when you return to the next card, which is the Sun card. And notice that the name for the letter is Nun, which means a fish and flower. And you have these two characters with obvious the Christ in the Sun and the person below with the Mogen David in their chest, rising up and greeting the Sun. This goes back to the last movement where we had this kind of vertical rising, which was that we saw in our sequences beforehand, which was in the Last Judgment. So we have the Last Judgment, and then we go into this, and then we also go into the Death card, where we also have an Ascension, and the Hermit card, where there's an Ascension. Then we go into this settled position, and we go into the sort of womb of that settled position, and now we're back to an Ascension again, with the connection being the meaning of the fish, right, which is in this classic ideogram from early Christianity, where iota, j, theta, epsilon, sigma, Jesus Christ, anointed God's Son and Savior, representing the name for fish, becoming the secret name of Jesus Christ as is the Son of God. And actually the fish was long before the cross became the primary symbol for Christianity. The fish was, the classic fish was the symbol of Christianity. And we're talking hundreds of years. The fish symbol was, they didn't use the cross. The cross became part of common iconography after Constantine, you know. So after the establishment of Christendom. So at least in terms of movement, if we have a pretty long sequence of what I would call incubation series, which is and by incubation we have ascending levels of light, and it's definitely between the Last Judgment and the Sun, we have a return. And of course, you can also see how, in some ways, the crown that was on the top of the head of the ascending thing in the Last Judgment has moved into the heart of the person who's on the ground here, greeting Christ with a hallelujah sign. Arms straight up, and Christ's arms down, assuming that is the Christ image in the Sun, arms are down. hallelujah, benediction. And the colored ones seem to portray that pretty much the same way. Of course, as soon as we have this movement, this, as it were, this obvious upward movement, we have a another movement which seems to be upward too, but of a different order. It's also downward. This is the movement of the devil. So again, the figures are standing, which means that they're in transformation, as is the sun. So you have the sun and the devil, the light bringer and the light. I think so. The light bringer is actual sun, because the name of the letter assigned there means prop, support, lean, and assist. So in some ways, the devil is the assistant of bringing forth of the Christ. And this view of the devil, which is actually supported with the next card coming up, which are the lovers, may have something to do with the way you don't vanquish the shadow, you incorporate the shadow into the restoration of paradise. There isn't this casting the shadow into the darker reaches of hell. That's not how we get back to paradise. The way we do it is we have to assimilate the shadow in such a way that it becomes assists the birth of light, the birth of the lovers. And the lovers here are, in that way, that's the, you could say the shame or the grief of the Adam and Eve. Again, nude figures, representing innocence, but also, but then also kind of humility. And then we have with the lovers, which is also named Eden, we have the two trees, which represent, like again, like what David said, which were the two pillars. And we have the angel. Well, let's see. Normally, what is an angel called normally with the lovers?
Yeah.
Well, Michael, obviously. But what we have here is we're having.
Apples on the parrot. I mean.
Yeah.
What do you call it? Temperance. I think that's Raphael.
Raphael? Okay, well, let's see.
Uriel was the devil. Raphael was the angel on the lover's card.
Hod Mixer. Hod Mixer. Michael, actually, is the one I have here. But the Michael or Haniel was Raphael is Tepereth. So would more go with the Christ.
How did you get that? Is that a different information or what?
It may be that I'm dealing with the Golden Dawn angel distribution here. But,
I thought Gabriel was on the judgment card, Temperance with Michael.
Well, wait a minute. We don't go with, the Rider-Waite-Smith stuff. We go with the, I'm getting my angel, designations through the Sephira. meaning, so Tempereth is Raphael, Netzach is Haniel, Hod is Michael, Yesod, Moon is Gabriel, Makuth is Sandalphon. But I'm not saying that that necessarily holds for this series. But the thing I want to emphasize with the lovers is the two trees and the canopy of the two trees that Adam and Eve are holding hands, and that this is the beginning of the restoration of Eden. In other words, this is the, in terms of the illuminate process that we've been going through, the sort of rebirth process that these cards have been going through, we are now, as it were, in that way you can see that Lucifer, or the devil, represents, you could almost say, the midwife of the birth of the sun. And Adam and Eve represent the birth of the sun as the human representations passing through the two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil, as a kind of beginning of the restoration of paradise. So there, in other words, this is a return to Eden. That's kind of my full interpretation of what the sequence is all about. We're having ourselves, that the illuminative way is our way back into a life that sees the world in its pristine before the fall way. Now, there is a deeper mystical path beyond the return to Eden, and there's also and there still is some serious discrimination that take place. Again, with temperance, the mouth, we have that profound orientation of that's very close to this. And here, actually, you can see how it's written out right on the card what the designations are. You have Yesod, you know. The two pillars written there in the you have the water coming down, and one is Chesed and Geburah. So with temperance, we have a lot of the high priestesses. People see the,
yes,
the similarity there. And again, so we're beginning to consolidate the unity of the action of the tree, of this whole thing. Continuing along, the next one we have is the moon, the sun and the moon, and the two towers, but also storm clouds. And the moon is part of this soul part shining as the Shekinah. It's between Netzach and Yesod. Represents the perfect human being in the sense of being a reflection of the sun. So, but it's also the moon is like the servant of the sun. In other words, the purpose of the moon is to reflect on the sun, and of course, the next card we have is justice. And I thought during the week, probably I thought more about this card than any other. I don't know why. But one of them has to do, again, with the central pillar aspects being extremely important. The lightning bolt up at the top is important because, in some ways, that lightning bolt at the top, and you see the figure at the top, is like, mm-hmm. is is a human being with the arms stretched out into a cross, and that is very similar to. And then when we have the tower, we have almost a you could say it's a reversed image, though you have the lightning coming down here into justice into this tree, and again the. You could say that the way that the fruits or the lights or the flames that are in the tree are bringing up, and then of course we have the souls that are still bound going in one direction and the other. And for me, the interesting thing about this justice, as opposed to the normal justices that we're used to seeing, is that with her sword down that way, she is in the, whereas the sword held up is, I can use this to discriminate. In other words, it's sort of like I have the power to separate the right and the wrong. With the sword down in this position, my interpretation is that she is actually separating the, those who are worthy of being in Eden and those who are not. So in the restoration of Eden, which is in the moon card showing, this separation. And then with the star, again, this is again a return to very close to the temperance thing, again with the water coming down. But again, the two pillars, and as David said, which is bringing everything back to Doth. And now, of course, Doth is that of the illuminate version. In other words, the person, ones who have been redeemed from fallen knowledge to the true knowledge of the world. And of course that the last thing that has to go is the Tower of Babel, which comes at the place of comes to the place of judgment, the class of the second coming of Christ. In her case, the lightning struck tower basically is the way I'd interpret it now is we have to let go of our images of what we think the divine is in order that the true divine can grow within us. In other words, that when we move into the world card and we begin a third ascent through the Tree of Life, which would be another sequence of cards that would open up the unitive path. This is the illuminative path. I don't know if, I don't find this that much as clearly in Waite's writings, but it would be a different, different arrangement if we're using the major arcana. To show the units of path would be a different interpretation and arrangement of the cards. So I know that we've shot through these things incredibly quickly, even jumping over the star for a matter of fact. But the what's nice though about it is that we have time to bring up any things that anybody wants to bring up here. This is it.
So the last card, the world card, brings up the opportunity for the unitive.
Well, I mean, everything is, from the point of view of God, we're always unified in God.
No, I understand.
But for the opportunity is that when we were purified before we went on this journey, in other words, when we came to the presence of the sacraments, and were baptized and came into the presence of the sacraments and the knowledge of and through the action of the sacramental knowledge, we go through a purification. The purification is a purification that leads to the ability to realize the difference between one's fourth life, the life that we, our limited life here in the world, in our eternal life. And that one of the things that illumination does is it makes us aware that we have a limited life in this world, and at the same time we have an immortal life in the illuminated world. In other words, we have access to return to Eden, where we're beyond birth and death. And of course, that's why the one of the last cards being the tower is that one of the things that has to break, fall apart is our presumptions that we can know this, that we can actually even do this through self-effort. The unitive way, classically, is fully God-directed. In other words, or it's divinely directed. It's not directed by human intention or effort. Where human intention and effort does pay off is through the sacramental life. In other words, you can continue to move in and to partake in the sacraments and in the purification and transformation that the sacraments do within your own self, so that you become aware of the difference between your immortal self and your mortal self. And you can recognize that the mortal self isn't something to be cast away or looked down upon, but rather to be seen as the precious thing that it is, because in this process you are allowed to see grow within you this ability of light, and that this light has the capacity to bring you into the motions of the divine, moving you towards divine union. And all the motions of the divine to divine union are by initiative of the divine. At that point of full illumination, your self-effort in a lot of ways evaporates. Self-effort makes perfect sense in this world. You know, you gotta do what you gotta do. You gotta have an ego to have an ego to make things work. That's great, but when it comes to your inner life, having an ego is not of too much sense when the ego is seeking to discourse with the angelic realms and with the true self and the immortal possibilities. And then, if anything, the ego is in the way. In fact, that whole initial purification is to basically realize that a lot of our constructed self that we've had to make ourselves work in this world can in a way prevent us from learning the more subtle ways that one can work in the other world. The nice thing about the illuminative path and the unitive path is that when they happen, they're very strongly experiential. I mean, you know, we're trying to language stuff which may or may not be in our sense of experience, or we're all differently integrated in how this may have anything to do with real experience for us. In language, when we're talking about things that are so incredibly personal, that really represent your innermost longing, the most beautiful, most precious, most powerful, and most intimate image of pure love and purpose and pleasure that could possibly ever be in one's life, that can sustain one through all travails in life to some degree. It's not necessarily easy, and each of us by our own, through our own ways, can approach, this inner life and being open to it in its own way. It doesn't have to be necessarily in a Christian way, but you know, the unfoldment of the soul in a lot of ways is universal to human beings in different ways, and that there are, and that all the religions in some ways are trying to kickstart us into part of becoming being a human being is to realize some of this wonderful stuff. Because this stuff is the beauty that no one can ever take from you. This is the wealth that can never be devalued, by the sleight of hand of Wall Street. This is happiness that cannot be blighted away. I'm a mystic, so I've always, of course, I think this stuff's important. And I think that for all intents and purposes, in all probability, abiding in the sanctuary is a vision of, a significant portion of the spiritual path. For me, it's sort of a central portion of the spiritual path. All right, I should stop talking for a moment, see if anybody else has got anything they want to say.
I look at the last picture of the world's corridor. I like that picture a lot. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful, I would say photograph. It's not. It's a painting.
If you look at of the three, which one do you like the most?
I like the first one.
The one that has the most detail in it, then.
That a lot. I think that it really speaks to me of the eternal dance. She's dancing the eternal dance. She's caught in the physical world. The world has physical laws, and the laws are not only for the world, but for the universe in general, and she has to continue that dance. And the kaf, the thing around her waist, kaf, represents the hand of God that's directing her in that dance, and she's contained inside this wreath of things, a laurel wreath, which is the eternal wreath that she has to be contained within. And to me, that looks like hair, I suppose, but it could also be the abyss in which she stands in front of. It's like the dot, it's the doorway again into the abyss. And she either makes the choice to go in it or to continue the dance.
Well, actually, one of the things that's pretty common in a lot of these is this long hair. I mean, the star, she's got long, long hair. It's a very strong image in many of the nude and clothed feminine images that she's got this super long hair. And
it also looks like a doorway. It looks like a space in the background. And to me, that really speaks to me. It's Doth again. It's the beginning of the cycle.
Yeah, the beginning of a new cycle is the way I would see it. A dissertation that one could do would be to say, if this is the illuminated way, one would be to do a much more systematic comparison between the associations of the Golden Dawn, Rider-Waite-Smith, Tree of Life paths, then be more clear about these paths, and then, doing some research or inner research, what would be a third movement of the Tree of Life with different paths for the unit of one? How could the 22 major arcana, how would they arrange themselves to lead one to pure unity? And if they were to do so, how would they be arranged? How would the paths be different? And what would be the rationale for that? As I said, I mean, that's a big dissertation. It would be a lot of inner work. I wouldn't try to do that in a class particularly, unless I myself had kind of figured it out ahead of time. But then I could be so wrong about it that it wouldn't make necessarily any sense to try to instill people into the wrongness of my view of it. Because what we're talking about there is we're talking about the divine initiative. And my view of divine initiative is divine initiative comes along in any different way, and that ultimately any of the cards, any of the major arcana, can be between any of the sephira, so, which would mean that there's literally no end to the possibility of the paths that could be brought up, and that having, but it's also, I think it's also healthy that we realize that the paths are not, that there's just not one system, that there's several systems, and that, and ultimately there could be as many systems as imaginable, and that they all could have a profound rational, a profound rationalization.
And one aspect of using something like tarot cards, which come from the gaming system, is that it probably is a non-linear process. We have to language it in a linear way to show that it probably, as life is lived, it's not a linear process.
That's it.
I think the abiding in the sanctuary had a very nice flow to it, starting with God and really ending with
beautiful.
It was a beautiful flow, and the thing is that it's only one method, and things like you're saying, Paul, there's zillions of other methods you can latch onto.
Well,
I think you gotta,
the one you're likely to latch onto is the one that's prodding, that's being prodded from your own soul growth. You know,
right.
I think what we've got is we've got maps. And, when you actually get out in the territory, you're going to find that, some maps don't work anymore because, some things have changed. You know, and that may not, it may be that they're not open to you to go a certain way. You got to go another way of things. Like when we did the Promethea story and her rising through the tree, she didn't take every path. She just took one. Just went one way up. I think she basically went the way of the lightning or something.
Either the lightning path, yeah.
Yeah, she just took one road up there, and we dealt with all of those at that level, and it was, but it was quite illuminative in the sense that it gave a nice way of showing how the Crowley's Thoth deck could be an initiatory system.
Listen, we're at the end of the session here, but Paul, I want to ask you a question. You put on the on your website that what's the name, Ivan Semensky? Was that her?
Yeah.
That book.
Yeah.
I looked at that. That's very interesting. That book. And did you buy that book?
I've got a copy of it around here someplace. Yeah, I have. I read part of it, and then it got lost in the shuffle. It's around here. I'm going to dig it up.
I didn't want to pay $30 for it, but I was wondering if you had it. It was worth buying.
It's a small book. It's kind of intensely written.
It's quite intensely written.
Yeah. I have a lot of her stuff on my website. I'm actually a mirror website for a lot of her published things. She's given me permission to, they're in, on my website, but, they're attributed to her and to her stuff.
I just went into the book, they give you a chance, and Amazon gives you a chance to go into the book. And so I did go into the book and read several of the pages, and I thought it was quite interesting.
Katrina Wynn just came up with her review of it. She's actually asked me if I would do a review of it. I'm actually due to do a review. I got a whole bunch of tarot books I should be writing reviews of. I've got a Rachel Pollack's book I want to do a review of. I've got Enrique Enriquez's book I want to do a review of.
It's going to go so many days in a week.
Yeah, that's true. And eventually I've got to do something that makes that brings in some money so that I can afford to go to a reader studio this year,
Yeah, We're not going to be able to make it this year, but in some of these days again.
Well, maybe, I don't know. With a little bit of luck, I might get to the West Coast for
Bats.
Yeah, for Bats. I'm not sure. That's not.
Is there also a Dallas meeting with Cats, Terrell professional?
Yes, there is. He's got a thing going with. I think he's calling it TaroCon or something now.
Monster's Cats is doing something in Dallas.
Yes, in October.
October, wow.
And actually, I think Johanna is signed up to go. Were you planning on going to the Dallas one, Johanna? She's still here?
I'm still here. Coughing, but still here. Okay. I have. But he's not letting any information.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay.
I guess we're finished with our.
Okay, let me turn it off.